Okay, the truth is that I wrote that on the bulletin, we had written that this week's subject would be Yetzias Mitzrayim, a personal experience. But since it's usual olam, I want to actually, that's the next stage. I want to first finish the Pesach Matzah Umara we began last week. Then we'll see if we get on to the next stage. So we spent most of last week's shiur on the Pesach. We discussed the matzah. I want to discuss briefly a little bit more about the matzah, another angle on the matzah, and then we'll move on to the maror, and then we'll see what we'll have time for at the end. But that's so the matzah. Last time we basically discussed the idea of the activity of the matzah, the speed which we manifested on Hashem's part, that issue of Hashem showing us that now you act with speed and alacrity, with energy, energetically. On my part, I'll do the same for you. Also, the idea of Hashem being on top of the situation and making sure that we would not reach a place where it would already be chametz, too late. But there are some other elements, not just in the making of the matzah, but in the nature of the matzah itself, which should be noted. Matzah is pure. That's the fundamental characteristic of the matzah, is its purity. Meaning, there are no other ingredients. It's flour and water. It's the most pure form bread can take. And not only pure of external additives, but it's also pure from its own internal additives. Meaning, when bread is left to leaven, that means that things are starting to develop inside. Bacteria, whatever it is, and there's all kinds of foreign elements developing within the bread itself. Matzah is bread in the most pure form possible. And this, Hashem wants us to eat at Yetzias Mitzrayim, because actually what He's doing on Yetzias Mitzrayim, taking us out as an Am Hashem, that's what He's doing us. He was bringing us to a state, mamish like Pesach was the birth of the Jewish people. A newborn baby in the most pure form, completely unadulterated, unencumbered with any past. There was no past. It was all starting now. Unencumbered with any past. Unencumbered with any baggage, right? That's the idea. No baggage, right? All other kinds of bread and cakes, etc. They're all kinds of baggage. Matzah is completely pure. Now, this has a couple of elements to it. First of all, it's just manifesting the very fact that now we are being moved, like we discussed with regard to the Karban Pesach. At the Leil HaTzeder, Hashem moved us onto a higher plane. We were elevated to a higher plane from the rest of human, from the rest of mankind. We became the Am Hashem. We're now sailing way above the rest of mankind. We're operating on a much higher sphere. We don't share any of the values, any of the objectives that other nations share. What other nations strive for, what other nations consider national success, doesn't interest us. And what does interest us, none of the nations share with us. We're on a completely different plane. We're operating on a completely different plane. That's why, by the way, for example, you know, one of Chazal's dictums was that the Jewish people during the Galus, they should take an approach of Loitis Garu Be'umas. Don't provoke the nations. Right? Now, it's often misunderstood as a certain dovish approach. We should just be nice and placid and, you know, why can't we be a little bit, you know, assertive and assert our might? We have to understand the Chazal is saying something much more profound. All the nations in the world, for them, success means might, power, etc. Chazal is telling us, you have to always keep conscious of the fact that we have a completely different agenda. We have no problem lowering our head and not coming out on top in that sense, right? Not asserting ourselves as the mighty ones, not elbowing to show that we're from the greatest powers in the world. Why? Because we have a different agenda. We would prefer, you know what? We'll be underfoot as long as we can keep doing our thing. That's more important to us. These issues that other nations are into elbowing about, simply don't interest us. If anything, on the contrary, it's going to distract us from our true agenda. And therefore, that's really the depth behind this concept of loitiskau be'umas. Don't provoke the nations. Meaning, really, the point is for ourselves. Don't get into that mahalach of having to show, you know, we're stronger. By the other nations, their whole standing depends on that. We don't need any of that. That's not our agenda. Don't become distracted. Once you do start getting into that, that can turn into your whole focus. That can turn into your whole objective. You become completely distracted from what our true national agenda is. So, we're eating the matzah to show that we are now coming to a very pure place. We're being raised above what the rest of Olam Hazeh is about. We're on a different plane. Matzah says, the man was matzah. The man was matzah, whatever this means. This was heavenly bread. Heavenly bread. This was bread that was eaten by the members of the heavenly classes. Right? To remind us that we're in a pure place. We're in a different plane. We're in a different sphere than the rest of the world. This is what the matzah is coming to impress upon us. That's also, by the way, why in the Beis HaMikdash, everything is matzah. There's no chametz in the Beis HaMikdash. It's got to be pure. That pure bread. The Beis HaMikdash is a place that's above Olam Hazeh. Beis HaMikdash is Shar HaShemayim. That's where heaven meets earth. Everything in the Beis HaMikdash has to be on a divine level. And therefore, the Beis HaMikdash all year round, all they could eat was matzah. And the Jews on Lel Pesach are being told, live in the Beis HaMikdash. This is really what your historic role is. Live above what the rest of the world is about. Live in that pure sphere of only spiritual achievement and activity. Pure of any of the different additives and baggage that the involvement in this world comes along with. The eating the matzah, connect to that purity. Connect to that purity. The purity that's becoming our historic lot, our national lot. And there's another element to this also. The matzah. This the Maharal brings out. Okay, those of you who have been with us in an English here have heard this, but bears repetition. The Maharal says that matzah actually, for this very reason, the fact that it's got no baggage, nothing attached, no additives, represents independence, represents absolute freedom. How's that? So the Maharal says something paradoxical. We might think it's paradoxical. We might think that the more a person has, the more capable he is of achieving success. But the truth is that the Maharal says it's really the opposite. The epitome of a person who can achieve success is a person who requires nothing in order to achieve success. Meaning, who's luckier? A person who needs cigarettes? Let's say cigarettes are healthy, okay? I just want to make that point. A person who's addicted to cigarettes and has all the cigarettes he wants, or a person who's not addicted and doesn't need the cigarettes. The person who's not addicted is a much more secure place because he doesn't depend on them. Right now this other guy has the cigarettes, but maybe tomorrow he won't. Right? So he's much more dependent. The truth is that it's like this with all materialism. The more a person depends on, the less free he is to truly achieve. So you have a person who's very wealthy, but without that he wouldn't be able to achieve, so he depends on that. What happens if one day he won't have it? He'll be stuck. He won't be able to achieve. And therefore, the Pasuk says, Doshe Hashem lo yachsiru kol toy. Those who seek out Hashem lack no good. Doesn't say they'll have everything good, or really Lapian points out. Doesn't say that they'll have everything good. It says that they don't lack anything good. Meaning, they don't need it. The people whose lives is about just connecting to Hashem, they don't need anything in order to feel fulfilled in life. And therefore, they're always in position to achieve success. They don't need anything. They don't depend on anything. That's right. That's what I'm getting to. Rabbi Eli Lapian says, it's Marshall. Says it's like a person. I have a sick person, a sickly person. Wherever he goes, he has all his, you know, his boxes with all the different pills that he takes. And you come into his house, you see on the shelves are lined with bottles and jars. Right? He comes to visit his friend's house, he walks into the house, shelves are bare. No pills, no nothing. He says, how can you manage? How can you manage without all the pills, without all the bottles, without all the drugs? And the person says, I don't need them. The truth is, that's what materialism is in a big way. A person who depends on materialism is a poor man. The person who doesn't need any of them is a free man. We mentioned this, those who heard it, bear with me, but the illustration of this is the story of the stipler. The stipler was in Shiduchim, so he was getting offers of all kinds of very, very wealthy people who wanted to have him as their son-in-law, and they offered to support him. But the stipler preferred a poor girl. A girl who came from a destitute home, but was fiercely committed to a life of Torah. And he said, just very straight logic, that if I marry a wealthy girl, who knows, maybe her father will lose everything he has, and then where will I be? But if I marry a girl who grew up with nothing, and she wants to really commit her life to Torah, she'll be able to make do with nothing. So we won't need anything in order for me to dedicate my life to Torah. I'd rather not need anything, because then I know that I can. Nothing will stop me. I'm not inhibited in any way. That's what happened. Married a poor girl. They lived in poverty their whole life, and they were both very happy. And he became the stipler. But cousin is sister, right? Right, right. So that's the idea of simplicity actually being independence. The less encumbered you are, the less baggage you have, the more independent you are to achieve whatever it is you want to achieve. The more external factors you depend on for success, what's your concept of success? Like we said before, on a national level, if your concept of success is victory, is might, so you depend on having the best scientists, the best, and hoping that no other country will develop a better arsenal. But if your national success is spirituality, you're always free to do it. On a personal level too. If your picture of success is wealth, it's not in your hands to become rich. And even when you do become rich, you might lose it. If your picture of success is spirituality, there's nothing that can ever inhibit you. Because every single situation in life provides room for growth. A person might say, what happens if my wife doesn't let me learn? What happens if I have all kinds of tzaras I can't learn? Okay. Hashem is telling you, I want you to grow in a different way. I want you to grow in a different way. Well, let's say a person really can't learn. Right? People make the mistake of thinking, my spiritual growth depends on my picture of spiritual growth. But when you understand that every situation that you are in life, let's say your mom is in a situation where you really can't learn. Person Rachmana Litzlan is in Siberia. Okay? How can he grow spiritually now? When you understand that, no, there is no such thing as a situation that doesn't offer opportunity for growth. Just, you have to see it right. You can't get thrown by the fact that, one minute I planned on spending my life learning. Now I find myself in Siberia. Right? What do I do now? No. When you understand that, okay, the whole challenge is, what opportunity for growth does this present me with? Siberia? So now, it's to remain solid in your emunah. Etc. Bavram Grodzinski, the Mashkiach of Slabodka, when he was in the ghetto, I think it was the Lodz ghetto, under the Nazis, they had nothing. They were tortured. He was already in the hospital, the ghetto hospital. Basically, the ghetto hospital, the treatment was basically incineration. But he said, what can I do? What avodah can I do? I'm going to provide everybody around me with sefer panim yafis, with a smile and a few words of encouragement. Every situation holds opportunity for spiritual growth. And therefore, when a person's agenda in life is spirituality, he's completely uninhibited. Nothing can prevent him from growing. So someone asked, I was saying this one time, and somebody asked, well, maybe you need at least the bread and water. That's the beauty of what we're saying. You don't. Not having bread and water is another opportunity for growth. It's also Hashem challenging you to respond in a certain way. We shouldn't know. But chas v'shalom, a person is in a situation where he's starving to death. Even death itself is an opportunity for growth. When a person's life is dedicated to spirituality, he is the epitome of a free man. That's why we say, in lecha ben chayin elamisha isek b'tayra. Right? A free man is a person who is engaged in Torah. When a person's life is a life of Torah, he's absolutely free to accomplish and to achieve whatever situation he's in. And therefore, it's that matzah, which is just no baggage. There's nothing to it except the most basic form of bread, the flour and the water. This is our existence. the less we need, the less we're encumbered with, the less additives there are in our lives, the less our existence entails, the more we'll be able to achieve what our real success is, what our real function in life is. What's that? Oh, no. That's interesting. It's connecting Shemayim V'Aretz. Oh, we were talking, wondering. I was wondering about that. How we call it, the most, in the purest element. At the end of the day, it's flour and water. So I guess that's the answer. Good. Okay, these are some of the thoughts as far as matzah goes. And now, Mara. Mara, in a way, challenges us with one of the most profound avoidas of Pesach, which isn't easy. We saw that the Pesach, the Korban Pesach, has its challenges, right? It challenges us toward Mesirus Nefesh. It challenges us to completely purge ourselves of any foreign attitudes. Matzah challenges us to reach that pure state. Mara challenges us to an avoida which is not easy. Appreciation. Why do we eat the Mara? Why do we eat the Mara on Pesach? The answer is obvious. We're commemorating the Shibud. Why are we commemorating the Shibud? Why do we have to remember the bondage? Why do we have to remember the difficulties? The simple understanding, the pashat, the pshat is, but the profound pshat is, we have to remember what the situation was in order to appreciate the fact that Hashem took us out. In order to do that, you have to really go back and live that situation. We're all born as free men. How many of us ever really took out the time to appreciate the fact that I'm a free man? In order to appreciate that you're a free man, you have to have experienced what slavery means. We never experienced slavery. But with the Mara, we're meant to sit down and focus a little bit on what could have been. When we complain about what we don't have in life and what's not going right, etc., etc., Lamaisi, you wake up in the morning, you're your own man, and there isn't a taskmaster whipping you out of bed at 4:30 in the morning. Who would think of being grateful about that? Yes, Abraham Lincoln came along a long time ago. Now we have to realize that when we're eating the Mara, to really try to picture what could have been and what should have been. And appreciate it. Avodah of appreciation is not an easy avodah. To be able to picture how things could have been different, but they aren't different, is not an easy thing. There's a famous incident with Rabbi Avraham Eben Ezra. He was a very, very, very poor man. Just had terrible mazel his whole life. He's the one who said that if I were to... He wrote these cynical poems, sardonic poems. One of his poems he wrote that if I were to produce candles, if I were to manufacture candles, night would stop falling. And if I were to produce shrouds, people would stop dying. That was basically his kind of writing off his mazel. So at one point in his travels, in his different rounds, he found himself in England. He had a following, a very wealthy Talmidim. But he wasn't willing to accept gifts from people. And they didn't... It was frustrating for them. They wanted to help him out. He was having such a hard life. Frustrating for them. They couldn't, because he wouldn't accept anything. So finally they came up with a scheme. They decided they're going to take a pouch, fill it with gold coins, make sure there's no simen, right, halachically, make sure there's no simen, and put it right in the middle of the path where he goes from his quarters to the Bismedrash, and they'll plant it there right before he leaves his house. Nobody else will walk by beforehand. They'll plant it there, they'll run away, and he'll just see it there and it'll be his. Okay, so they did that. They put that pouch down right in the path leading from his house to the Bismedrash. But Eben Ezra's mazel was the Eben Ezra's mazel. He walked out of his house, they hid, and they were watching to see. They were watching to see him find the gold coin. He walks out of his house, the Talmidim couldn't believe their eyes. He walks out of his house with his eyes squeezed shut. That's how he was walking out of there. Walking down the path with his eyes squeezed shut. Walked right past the pouch. Eyes squeezed shut. Until, what happens if you walk down the street for long enough with your eyes squeezed shut? You trip. Right? And that's what happened. He tripped on something, fell down, scratched himself, opened his eyes, gave a big smile, got up and walked the rest of the way to the Mishmedrash with his eyes open. The Talmidim were watching this and they're completely puzzled. They're scratching their heads. What on earth is going on? And they came to him in the Beis Medrash and they said, why did you go to shul with your eyes closed? He said, how do you know? What? So they told him, kind of like resigned themselves to the fact that they're not going to... They told him what they had done. So he laughed and he said, if this is my mazel, you're not going to beat it. And you want to know why I was doing this? Exactly today, he came out. He said, I was in my room, and I was thinking to myself how miserable I am. What a miserable life I have. Nothing, you know, it's so difficult, etc. And then I thought to myself, 1 minute, everything is bad? Could be a lot worse. What happens if I couldn't see? So I thought to myself, that's really something to appreciate. I'm going to do that. I'm going to feel what it feels like not to see, and then I'll be able to appreciate the gift of eyesight. So I decided I'm going to walk as far as I can from this bedroom with my eyes closed. And that's what happened. So I walked, I couldn't see until I tripped. I said to myself, wow, it's a good thing I can see. I opened my eyes and I felt like a rich man. I walked the rest of the day from this medrash. The truth is that this is a challenge. It's a challenge that we're all expected to do, because really, our service of Hashem should be motivated by feelings of gratitude. According to the Chovos HaLevavos, that is the greatest level of service of Hashem. When all the mitzvahs and all the service that a person does is motivated by feelings of gratitude. And a very important part of really developing their gratitude, it's very hard to feel gratitude for things that you grew up in, that were always a part of your life, and that you feel are a natural part of you. It's very hard to feel gratitude for these things. So, the way to develop it is to use your imagination to try to imagine how things could have been otherwise. This is endless. You take a walk in a hospital, the people whose systems failed. You start feeling appreciation. People your age, your place in life. But they have this problem, they have that problem. You walk out of the hospital, thinking about what it means for a person to come to the hospital a few times a week for dialysis. Kidney problems, living always with that constant fear. What he would give to be able to live the life that you have, with all the troubles that are harassing you. But you don't have that on your head to go to the hospital three times a week. You know what a lucky man you are? Or, how much would people pay? A person who's going to lose it, who's in a position where he might have to lose an arm. How much would he pay for a surgery to be able to save his arm? $500,000 people would pay. You have it for free. Think about that a little bit. So tomorrow, the point is, Hashem is saying, after you came out of Mitzrayim, it's fundamental that you remember what it felt like. Now, we won't remember what it feels like. But at the end of the day, we're eating tomorrow to experience the bitterness and to try to think what could have been, what should have been, what would have been otherwise. And to feel that commitment to Hashem's service because of the feeling of gratitude of what could have been otherwise. This is the challenge of the morrow. That issue of the appreciation of what we are today, by realizing what should have been, what could have been, what should have been natural. That's one element of the morrow. Another element of the morrow is not to forget. Again, we said the morrow is commemorating the shibud, the bondage. A very important part of that is that at the end of the day, the bondage provided us with great benefits, with great lessons. And it's a challenge for us not to forget these things. For example, we see in the Torah, Vahavtem es hager, you should love the ger, you should love the foreigner. I'm not necessarily talking about, let's say, Pashto Pshat, not necessarily talking about a ger tzedek per se. A foreigner. You should love a foreigner. Why? Because you were foreigners in Mitzrayim, and you knew the feeling. Therefore, hold on to that feeling and be sensitive to others. Or, Jewish people are commanded to treat their slaves kindly. Why? Because we were slaves in Mitzrayim, and we know the feeling. In other words, a big function, it's not just incidental, a big function of the Shibud was to develop our characters in the right place. The Jewish people are a sensitive people. Suffering generates sensitivity. When a person has always been living his life comfortably, never had a lousy day, it's very hard for him to really commiserate, to really sympathize with people who are going through difficult times. And a very, very essential part of the Jewish personality is the smida of sympathy, of sensitivity. And this was actually one of the functions of the whole Shibud in Mitzrayim. When a person suffers, he comes away from that being able to relate to suffering people differently. It's like it was the Rav of Lomja, Rabbi Chaim Meisels. He used to, like many of the Rabbanim in those times, a big part of their job was collecting money for the poor of the town. And it was tough work, you know, trying to wrench money out of the wealthy, enough what you need for all the cases you're dealing with on the other side. So, one evening he came to one of the rich people in the town, a good person. Came, he knocked on the door, it was a freezing Polish winter night. He came and he knocked on the door. The fellow came to the door in his shirt sleeves, and he welcomed the Rav in, the covered. But Rabbi Chaim stayed outside. He started talking to him about a certain case. And this fellow is standing at the door inside. There's a nice warm house. He told, Rabbi, come in. We'll talk inside. We'll sit down in the parlor and we'll talk. I want to hear. Rabbi Chaim just kept on talking. And the guy was starting to get really uncomfortable, but it was unpleasant to interrupt the Rav. So he's standing there respectfully, and the Rav's going on and on. A few minutes go by, and the guy is starting mamish to shake. He says, Rabbi, forgive me for interrupting you, but let's step inside. Rabbi Chaim ignored him, kept on talking. About 10 minutes went by, and this guy's mom is shaking and quaking. His whole body is shivering violently. And finally, he's pleading with the Rav. He's telling, come in, come in, we'll sit at this fireplace. And the Rav told him, I wasn't just caught up in my speech. I kept you out here for a reason. But we're sitting at the fireplace, and we're discussing a family who has no firewood. And you're thinking to yourself, no, okay, yeah, they might need something, but you have never experienced, you have no idea what it's like. Now, you had a bit of an unpleasant experience. Imagine being stuck that way the whole night with kids, and you can't warm them up. So that's the idea again. You've experienced it. If you've actually tasted it a little bit, you're able to relate much more. So that's also part of the idea of the Mara. The Mara, the bitterness, was a humbling experience. It's something that we're supposed to take away with us. A humbling experience. Feel that we're able to maintain or develop the sensitivities that we're supposed to have as Jewish people. One last lesson of the Mara, and this is a little bit more of a historic lesson, lies in the halachas of Mara. It's kind of paradoxical. Mara is meant to commemorate the Shibud, and yet, what is the best, most optimal choice for Mara? The lettuce. Romaine lettuce. Out of the five kinds of mara, which are all pretty bitter, the only ones that we really know are the horseradish and the lettuce. Lettuce is the preferred choice. We might think, horseradish, but that's the real thing. Right? No. Lettuce is the preferred choice in halacha, the chasa. Why? So Chazal tell us, first of all, why is lettuce called mara? Lettuce tastes good. It's got a pleasant smell. It's almost a pleasant taste. It's almost sweet. Yeah? Yeah? What's mara about it? So Chazal tell us that, yeah, when you eat it, it's sweet. But the nature of this lettuce is that if you leave it in the ground, it's tchilasai masai kvasefai ma. If you pick it while it's at that ripe point, it's sweet. But if you leave it longer in the ground, it starts toughening, it starts turning bitter. The truth is that there is a shita in halacha that that's when you should be eating it. When you're using the lettuce as mara, that's when you should be eating it, at the bitter stage. But we don't pass it that way. We call it a chumr. It's a chumr of the chazanish. That's why many people also make a point of eating the horseradish too. But that's certainly not the general consensus. Beis Yosef clearly doesn't hold that way. No! You can eat it when it's at the sweet stage. Why? Because the maisa, it classifies as mara since it's got that nature. It begins sweet and it ends bitter.
Then you get the message from it?
Oh, so do you get the message from it? The question is, what's the message? So Chazal say, why is the lettuce the preferred choice? Because it's got this nature. Of tchilasai masak v'seifai ma, it begins sweet, ends up bitter, and that most represents how the Shibud worked.
The shibud was also tchilas and mosek v'sefer. How did the shibud begin? How did the bondage begin? The bondage began with Paray coming and making a grand declaration, an opportunity, a privilege. We're starting on a national campaign to rebuild different cities. Paray himself came out, he made a whole big ruach about it, and Paray himself came out, he offered great rewards for whoever's going to show loyalty to Egypt by partaking in this campaign. He came out with a golden brick around his neck, a whole working party, right? He made a whole ideal out of it, whole value out of it. And he himself came and he was working with the people. And they were trying to encourage the people to take part of it. It didn't start by force. And at the time, really what it was Paray doing? Paray came, again, the whole thing was undercover. People didn't know that there were lemaisa sinister meetings going on with Paray and his advisors. But that's not how Paray came across. Paray, an anti-Semite, chas v'shalom. Paray very much appreciated the contributions of Yosef to Mitzrayim. And therefore, on the contrary, the way Paray presented it was, starting a great campaign, we're going to continue the legacy of Yosef HaTzadik. He built great storehouses for the Egyptian nation, and we're going to do the same. And therefore it's dafka going to be the people of Yosef who are going to do this. They're going to do this with me. Made a whole campaign out of it. And offered great reward. And the people of Israel felt flattered, right? Look how important Paray considers them. He wants to make this special campaign with them. Look how much he values them. Poor losers. And there was one Shevet. At that time, all of the Shvatim had already died. All the sons of Yaakov except for Levi. Levi was the one patriarch who was still left. And he, this old timer, he told his family nothing doing. He saw straight through it. He said, just keep away, don't go. All the other Shvatim went. Now, we can understand them, right? Why don't go? You have to show solidarity with the nation that's hosting us, right? And okay, look, we're often here, the old time Rabbanim, they're not with the times, they don't understand the way things are supposed to be working. Now, they went. And then, it was a process. First few days, people came with enthusiasm. And then, well, the rewards stopped coming, but Paray, you know, you got notice that Paray expects to see you here tomorrow too. You weren't not going to show up. And slowly but surely it started developing into something forced. It became official. You weren't allowed to not show up once you started. But again, it was purely innocent. Meaning, okay, that's how it developed and it was unfortunate. But Paray was a good guy. He didn't have any malicious intents. That was how it was. What's that?
Once there's a forced labor, how can you say, oh, he has no malicious intent?
Well, the truth is that there was a lot of propaganda. Even when Paray, well, note this, you know what, let's start backwards. How does it begin? Sit around. Oh, I say this every day, but I don't remember.
What is this from?
From the Vachori Simaya Bruce. Right, we say it every morning. You performed great signs and wonders in Paray and in all of his servants, with all the nation of the land. Because, this is Nehemiah talking, because you, Hashem, knew, you knew that they had malicious intent against them. And you made yourself a great name until this day. Meaning the truth is that it was a concealed campaign. It was not outright. And it was to the extent that it took a lot to see through it. And therefore he's actually saying, Hashem, you knew what was really going on. But many of the people at that time didn't. Paray came across as, look, first of all, at the end of the day, he had his nation's interests at heart. Couldn't blame him. Nothing against the Jewish people, but At the end of the day, this is a foreign nation. We do have to keep them under control. Look, the Chinese also, for the benefit of their nation, wanted to control breeding. Right? No, well, how did it work? No more than two children a family? One child a family. The national good. That's also wickedness. But it came across as national good. Even see, the parry is important for the Jews' own good to keep them from multiplying too much, because it'll just raise animosity against them. It's not worth it. It's not interesting to note that Pari made his plot with the midwives, right? He told them a secret plot he made with them. What's the idea? He calls them in, makes a secret plot with them, and expects them to cooperate. The idea was that here also, he presented it in a very politically correct way, as you see from the fact that afterwards he tells them, Madua asisan es hadavar hazeh. He approaches them with moral reproach. How could you have done this? When they went ahead and they continued producing, right? Klal Yisrael in great numbers, he calls them back afterwards. It's reproach, moral reproach. I explained to you the importance of what we're trying to do. How could you do this? This is wrong. But, yeah. Meaning, he presented it in a very politically correct way. Now, but Lamaisen, oh, it's true that at the end of the day, by the time the Jews found themselves well entrenched in it, they're already the victims of what had started innocently. I don't know if till the end people thought that Pari had malicious intent in the first place. It developed in an unfortunate way. And it turned into what it turned into. The truth is that that's what Rav Hirsch says. It says, it's a very interesting thing. Vayomos Melech Mitzrayim, the king of Mitzrayim died. Vayonchu b'nei Yisom in ha'avoyda v'yizoku. And then the Jewish people cried out. It reached an intolerable situation. We think the other way around. The king who started all the tzaras died. That's a cause that it reached an intolerable situation. Why is that what marked such a terrible stage? Rav Hirsch says, on the contrary, as long as he was alive, they lived with the feeling that he's going to stop it. He's going to stop it. He's going to alleviate. Like, he sees it's going too far. Right? This is not what he intended. He's going to feel guilty about it. Right? They're also trying to tell him, look, you know, it's going too far, etc. It was after he died that they gave up. They despaired, because the next king is not going to feel guilty about it. This is the existing reality. This is how it is. But as long as that first Pari was still alive, they still lived with the hope that at the end of the day, he's a good guy. It's going to stop. So the Jews were victims of Tchilasay Mosek V'Sofer. They were victims of this phenomenon of starting out sweet and turning out bitter. They fell for it. Hook, line, and sinker. We eat the mara. We're definitely told to eat this type of mara because this is a lesson we are meant to internalize. That don't fall for it. Don't fall for it. Do not grow close with the nations of the world. Today, it's not a politically correct thing to say. But we are always enjoined and always expected and always advised for our own benefit. Don't fall prey to their gestures. Don't fall prey to their signs of affection. Don't be a loser. It doesn't work. Chilasay Masak is just a test. It's not because the Jews were trying to get close and they were trying to flatter. They were trying to find favor in the eyes of the Mitzrayim. This is what ended up being their pitfall. It was the Shevet Levi who took the advice of their patriarch, who said, no, we have to retain our distance. We have to keep far away from them. Don't try to flatter them. Don't try to show the Jews can be as good citizens as Jews should live as good citizens, by the way, but according to the dictates of their own conscience. We understand what we need to be doing for a nation that we live among. Yes, you should be a good citizen. If you live in the United States, be a good citizen of the United States. But not according to their terms necessarily. You figure out what your moral obligation is to the country you live in, and that's all. Doesn't mean that you now have to become, identify yourself as an American and associate with American culture, etc., etc. No, we are a completely different people. And we have to remember that. Don't grow close to it. Don't get lost in it. Remember the lesson of Chilos HaMosek V'Seif Aymar. We have to keep ourselves aloof all the time. Don't find the sweetness that they offer us palatable. That's mamish. Hook, line, and sinker. You take the bait. This is the other message that the Maror is coming to bring across. Okay. Now, we'll just finish off. We began this whole series of shiurim by trying to put the Seder into the right perspective. As we're finishing off, we're going to finish off with the continuation of the Agada, which says, here I'm going to be loyal to the title in the bulletin. In each generation, every individual person is obligated to see himself as though he personally left Mitzrayim. Now, you aren't obligated to see yourself as something that isn't true. Chazal are telling us, don't just commemorate the fact that our forefathers went, but you have to view it as though, which means the Chazal saying that on the deeper level the truth really is that you yourself went out of Mitzrayim. What's the idea here? The idea here is really the whole perspective. You have to have the right perspective. You could have heard everything we've been discussing up till now and really be appreciating and amazed and mind boggles by all the great wonders that we're seeing in Mitzrayim. But there's another element that's very, very important to get all that in the right perspective. And that is the personal element. Realize that this was not done for our ancestors. Nor was it done for the Jewish people as a whole. It was done because Hashem wanted me. The Maral says that. At the time of Yitzias Mitzrayim, Hashem was actually envisioning each individual neshama and bringing about the Yitzias Mitzrayim, the redemption from Mitzrayim, because He wanted each individual. This is another manifestation of the concept of Bishvili Nivra Olam. Chazal say, every person is obligated to say, this is a fundamental in understanding our role in Hashem's eyes. If we want to understand Hashem right, we have to understand ourselves right. Every person is obligated to say, Bishvili Nivra Olam. Hashem created the world for me. What does that mean? That means that you are not a result of circumstance. You're not here just because your parents were Jews, they married, and here I am. Take it or leave it. No. Each Jew has to realize that he was specifically designed. Hashem was envisioning him from the earliest of times. Picturing him. Planning his appearance on the scene. And therefore, yes, Yitzias Mitzrayim is something that's to be experienced in a personal way. We say that the Jewish nation was born on Mitzrayim, right? That's really the bottom line of what we're celebrating. We're not celebrating independence. We're celebrating the creation of the Jewish nation. We're celebrating Hashem taking us as His people. But that's, again, not just on the national level. Hashem is choosing me tonight. He's choosing me. He's taking me out of Mitzrayim because He wants to have a sheiches with me. It's like we've said before, that actually what was going on throughout the Ten Makkos was Hashem courting the Jewish people in order to make His proposition to them. Hashem comes to them at Har Sinai when He's ready to propose marriage, and what does He say? Atem ra'isem es kol asher osisi b'Mitzrayim. You saw everything that I did in Mitzrayim for you. In other words, at the end of by the time the Jews were leaving Mitzrayim, Hashem was basically, it was a stage of engagement, if we'll call it that, right? Hashem dated the Jews. He courted the Jews in Mitzrayim by showing them everything He could do for them, how much He cares about them. You have to feel that on the Leila Seder as you're learning these things. When you're studying Dam, when you're studying Tzfadea, when you're studying the splitting of the sea, realize that these were lessons that were directed at you in a personal way. Hashem did these things because He wants you, not just because He wants the Jewish people as a whole, and you, by circumstance, are one of them. Hashem designed all of these phenomena specifically for you. And therefore, connect to Hashem on a personal level at the Leila Seder. Everything we've been discussing now has to be experienced on a personal level. You say, Dam, you're picturing in your mind what Hashem was doing because He wanted you out of Mitzrayim. You personally. Tzfadea, Kinin, Aroi. The whole story, the whole development. Why? Because He wanted a relationship with me. This is what you have to come away with from the Leila Seder. You're being born. You, tonight, were chosen. Again, the effect of the Seder night replays each Seder night. It's not just that it happened then and we're commemorating it now. That's what the Sfarim tell us. That each year there's that same hashpa'ah, the same opportunities, the same open doors up in Shemaim are actually happening again. That's why Pesach is a zman of hischadshus. It's a time of renewal. It's a time for tshuva in its own way. Tshuva in the sense of hischadshus. I'm beginning, renewing, I'm being reborn tonight. I'm starting again. Tonight, at the Leil HaSeder, Hashem is coming and showing me how much I mean to Him. That's what I'm doing when I'm studying the Haggadah. And therefore I'm coming away with a new, rejuvenated, refreshed, personal relationship with Hashem. He did all this because He wants a relationship with me? That's mind-boggling. It's awesome. Awesome in the way they used it 40 years ago, not the way they use it lately. This is the perspective that the Leil HaSeder should begin and end with. And Bezus Hashem can really be an impetus, meant to be an impetus, to take us to Matan Torah and to carry us all throughout the year until the next Leil HaSeder, Bezus Hashem.